Good afternoon. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Sandra. So Sandra is from upstate New York, which is, as I've just found out, it's 180 miles from Manhattan. So I've only been to Manhattan. I haven't been outside of that. So, and she says it's a very different world. And it's within views of the Catskill Mountains, which I remember from the film Dirty Dancing. That was my introduction to upstate New York. A very, very rural, lovely part of the world. So thank you for joining us today, Sandra. Great to have you on the show. Looking forward to chatting with you.
It's wonderful to be here, Simon. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Yeah, you're a star. Okay, Coasts, could you introduce yourself to the listeners, please, Sandra?
Sure. My name is Sandra Flack, and my husband and I have been married for 34 years. We have 8 children, 5 through adoption. One of them, our oldest daughter, who I must say is now 31, came to us at age 8 through a kinship placement. She was a relative. And then as time went on, we were led in the direction of international adoption, and we adopted a sibling group of 4 from Ukraine. They came home at 2 separate times. The first 3 came home in 2007. And then when we learned about the youngest child, the youngest sibling, we went back for him in 2010. And so we were just on that journey of parenting our children and started a nonprofit, Justice for Orphans, about 10 years ago, where we engaged the faith-based community in caring for children through foster care, adoption, wrapping around those families that are doing that, bringing awareness. I host a podcast also, Orphans No More, which is also my audience is primarily adoptive and foster parents, especially moms. So I try to encourage and inspire and equip them for the difficult journey that we're on. And recently wrote a book, Orphans No More, A Journey Back to the Father, which chronicles our adoption journey, why we adopted, the whole experience of adopting them and what life was like after they came home. And then really also what I learned about what I call spiritual adoption, being adopted into the family of God through the lens of being an adoptive mom, and how there's so many parallels between physical adoption of children and our spiritual adoption. So that's in the book as well. And I write and speak and do all the things, and really just try to encourage and support and equip foster and adoptive families.
Wow. Huge. I don't know how you find time to do all that.
Me either.
The thing that just popped out for me is the word encourage there that you said. Do you know where that comes from, that word?
Do I know where it comes from?
Yeah. Or the origins of that word, or what it means, or like, you know, split it down.
I know what I think it means. Teach me something new, Simon.
Okay. I don't know whether it will be new or not. But the reason the cur in encourage is heart in French. Mm. So I guess that would come from Latin, because lots of French comes from Latin. I gave up Latin after a year. I carried on with French. I didn't do so well on it. Maybe I should have given that up as well. But yeah, so the reason I mention that is because we only have people with big hearts on this show. So I thought that heart, you know, when you said encouragement, you were explaining all this work that you do to, obviously you're a heart driven and a spiritual driven person, mom and leader of this nonprofit and author. And so the cure for heart and encouragement kind of just popped out for me.
Wow. I love that. I didn't know that about it. I know that the journey of being a foster or adoptive parent, it can be difficult, very hard days. You can feel very isolated. Not everybody gets it unless they are also an adoptive or foster parent. So I'm still in the trenches. I said I have eight children, and that's true. I also have five grandchildren, but I only have two children still at home. They are 15 and 18. And so the journey is difficult, and I know what that's like. And I want to encourage others along the journey so that they can stay the course and be successful and cheer their kids on to success as well.
Yeah. I think, you know, this journey thing is in danger of becoming an overused term. You know, everybody's on a journey, aren't they? But they are. You know, sometimes cliches have become cliches because it's the truth. Yeah. So the purpose of the Thriving Adoptee podcast is to help everybody along their journey. So we're sharing lived experience rather than theories. And we are helping people along their journey. And I talk about, you know, the people's stories for inspiration and people's learnings for empowerment. And I'm just going to drop into another thing about inspiring for a word thing, because that really means, it meant a lot to me. I think it might mean to you, as, you know, obviously somebody from the faith-based community, as you say. Inspired comes from the Latin, which means in spirit. And so that's the spirit I'm not a religious guy, but I'm a spiritual guy. So I'm talking about the spirit that drives us. And I guess for you, it might be the faith that drives you, or it might be the spirit, or it might be something else. I don't know. What does it feel like for you?
I think it's a little bit of all of that. I know my faith is what drove me, to my husband and I, to want to open our home to help children. And we knew that I was sharing with you earlier, I'm in upstate New York. We live out in the country, have a lot of land, a pond, woods, and it's a idyllic place to raise children. And we were raising three biological children. And then when a little girl who, like I said, was a relative, her mom died of cancer. No one ever really knew what happened to the dad. He wasn't a part of their lives ever. And she was being raised by an elderly grandparent, and just grandma was mentally and physically unwell. So we were trying to help them, reach out to them, support them as best we could. And along the way, discovered this little girl was living in a very horrible situation. So long story short, with the court system and all of that, she came to live with us when she was about 8 years old. And then as time went on, a few years later, we pursued international adoption, really as a calling. We really felt led by God to open our home to orphans and to adopt internationally. Not a lot of people can do that. And not a lot of people are up to taking more than one child. And we felt really compelled to adopt a sibling group. They're harder to place. And so our faith had a lot to do with the why we stepped into this, and wanting to walk that out in obedience. But then just caring for these children and then encountering other families on the same journey, parenting kids with trauma histories and whatnot, like I said, can be lonely and isolating and hard. And we just, I think I am an encourager, and I just wanted to be able to help hold up the arms of weary fellow foster and adoptive parents.
Yeah. Yeah. So before we started recording, we talked about the kind of the trauma thread as a theme for today. So you've clearly been through a lot and continue to share what you've learned to encourage others, as you say. What sort of things would you like to share with adoptive and foster parents listening, who are in the trenches, as you say, struggling with this trauma stuff?
Yeah, so we didn't realize in the early years of being adoptive parents, we didn't have any understanding of trauma per se. I always say we came into this through the back door. We didn't take foster parenting classes. We just said yes to a relative and she came to live with us. And we thought she'll have a normal childhood now and we'll raise her like one of our own and we'll all live happily ever after. And this will be great. But she had many challenging behaviors and struggles from day one that we just, because we had no training, we thought she was just disobedient and difficult and defiant and, just hard all the time. I felt like I was always issuing consequences and she was never learning from consequences. It was a lot of hard stuff, but I just saw it as we'll just discipline and correct her and do behavior modification. And that's what we'll do. And then many years later, when we adopted our children from Ukraine, we brought home the first three children. And I had read prior to going to Ukraine, I read some books on attachment and that kind of thing. But we used an adoption agency in another state. I'm in New York. We used an adoption agency in a different state. So again, there were no classes for us to take. There was the only preparation I did was what I did myself. And I did read one little article about fetal alcohol syndrome because I had heard somewhere that that could be common in children adopted from Eastern Europe. So, but we adopted the three kids and they really clicked into our family pretty miraculously. There were little things, but most of it was they had to learn our language and we got, had to get to know each other and get acclimated and whatnot. But really there were no really challenging behaviors with them. And then a few years later, when we traveled back to Ukraine to get the youngest sibling who had been in the orphanage from birth to age five. So his key developmental years, he was in an institution where there was neglect and, not proper nutrition. There was no education, really, no love, no nurture. So the second we met him in the orphanage, when they brought him in for our first visit, we knew we were not equipped to parent this child. We knew there were some major things going on. I suspected the FAS, assumed that probably all of the neglect, maybe some abuse, all of that played into his just really feral, wild, out of control behavior. We had no idea how we would even get him home on an airplane. It was that difficult. And when we got him home, we just really struggled to keep our head above water for several months. And then I found the book, and maybe some of your listeners are aware of the book, The Connected Child by Dr. Karen Purvis. And that was a game changer for us because that book really shows you the impact of trauma prenatally, as well as, in childhood, the impact of that trauma on a child's brain and body, and how that impacts the behaviors we're seeing are really symptoms of this trauma. And then parenting through not a disciplinary behavior modification style, but through connection. And really, and I had spent so much time with our first adopted daughter trying to correct her behavior and felt so frustrated most of the time because she wasn't learning from those consequences. No behavior modification technique helped. That I didn't feel the warm fuzzies all the time. I didn't feel, I loved her, but it really impeded the connection that we should have been building because I spent so much time frustrated by her behaviors. And what I learned through The Connected Child is the first thing we really need to, not that we don't address behavior, but to build that connection And while we're connecting and empowering them and paying attention to things like the sensory environment and nutrition and activity and all of these different things, and while we are meeting those needs and helping them to feel safe and provided for, then we can connect with them. That goes such a long way. And then the book goes through some strategies on, you know, how to, for example, time in as opposed to time out. One of my favorite things to do with my older daughter, my first adopted daughter, because I struggled with her throughout the day, a lot of times I issued the consequence of an early bedtime, because that was her consequence. And then it gave me a break from having to deal with any more behaviors. But she never learned from that. And really what it was doing was it was preventing us from connecting, because there was a distance there. There was a disconnect. Nothing. She wasn't learning anything. She really needed to be brought close to learn and to feel loved and accepted and all of that. And what I learned through the connected parent really was it's time in, being with and modeling that right behavior and building that relationship. So that went a long way with helping us with our kids, because we were able to then go back and apply Dr. Purvis's methods. It's called trust-based relational intervention. And my husband and I actually went on to get some training in TBRI. And it's through what they call Empowered to Connect, which is for parents, foster and adoptive parents. And we got the training so that then we could help other foster and adoptive parents learn this same way of parenting. And it was really a game changer in improving things in our family. And so that helped us be very successful. And then as time went on, what became glaringly clear is our youngest, who, when we went to Ukraine, he was the 5-year-old that was out of control. He's now 15. And we had him evaluated, and he did get a diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome. And actually also his older brother, who we had brought home with the three, who's now 18, he also got a diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome. And then really life since then has been a journey on learning about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, which really exposure to alcohol in the womb impacts it. It literally changes the structure and function of the brain. So therefore the symptoms that we see that most foster and adoptive parents may be encountering, those challenging behaviors, are because of the brain being impacted by alcohol, which is really a trauma prenatally. And it's a lifelong, invisible disability. And as we've learned that, we have learned how to really parent, not just with the connection, first and foremost, yes, that, but also to understand that really this is a brain, it's almost like a brain injury. So you set your expectations much differently when you're parenting from the perspective of brain.
Because this is new to me. We've got a couple of other podcasts on the series, if everyone wants to check it out. One from Natalie Vecchioni, who was the lady that kindly introduced me to Sandra, and there's another one from Robbie Seal on this FSAD stuff. One other thing that pops into to my head is, to what extent do you share what you've learned with the kids? And by kids, I mean obviously teenagers. What, you know?
Yes.
How you know, to what extent? What do you do about what, you know? Because it's like going to cause. You know, you talked earlier on about, you know, modeling and learning and being the parent. And to what extent are you actually empowering the child as well?
So I wish we had started long ago. Like, I wish we had known more in the earlier days when they were little, to be able to really have, so that they could have had that understanding earlier on. but I really took a deep dive into fetal alcohol spectrum disorders in 2020 because even though my boys had been diagnosed and they had been getting special education at school and we knew some stuff, COVID really triggered some things in my youngest. And part of that is because he has a trauma history and all of a sudden the abrupt shutdown of school and everything normal in his world was turned upside down. That really triggered fear in him. And through some counseling, we discovered that he was really afraid that his dad and I were going to get COVID and we were going to die and he would be without parents again. So my heart just broke when I realized that was the deep-rooted fear behind all of this. But because of his disability, he struggles with change and he struggles with transition and he has a lot of anxiety. And COVID really triggered all like a big flare-up in that, just the whole, you know, this pandemic and this turning his world upside down. So I took a deep dive into really researching and reading and learning all I could about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, which I probably should have done many years earlier, but now it's like, okay, I'm getting in over my head again and I need to know what's going on. And I need to know how much of this that's going on is because of trauma, how much of it is because of the brain disability, what's going on. And really the answer was yes, all of it, you know, but the more I learned and the more I researched, and I too listened to Natalie's podcast, FASD Hope, and Robbie Seals is FASD Family Life. I follow their podcast. I listen to them. I've read books and articles and I've done the research. And then I started to realize that this is driving so much of what we're seeing. And it's so important to become informed and understand whatever disabilities our kids may be diagnosed with, we have to become the expert in that. So I had to become an expert in FASD. And in so doing, I realized things like in the United States, it's approximately 80% of the children in the child welfare system have been exposed to alcohol in the womb, whether they've been diagnosed or not. And most of them actually are either not diagnosed or they're misdiagnosed with something else. What's really going on is driven by the fact that they were exposed to alcohol in the womb and that their brain function and structure has changed. So I want my kids to be successful. So if I'd have, you know, if I was where I, if I knew, that's that old saying, if I knew then what I know now, right? I wish I had known it sooner so I could have really been equipping them. But as soon as I started knowing these things, I started realizing these guys need to know that because at some point in life, they are going to have to advocate for themselves as well. So my 15-year-old, and I homeschool him now because he had such difficulty in school with all of the changes because of COVID. He was not able to learn. He was in a constant state of survival because of the fear of this pandemic. We talk about the brain a lot and we talk about all of these different things. So he has a better handle on it. My 18-year-old presents differently. Not everybody with an FASD has exactly the same symptoms. There are, you know, I can share the primary symptoms of FASD. So there's a lot of overlap, but it can present differently. My 18-year-old has a lot of physical things, severe scoliosis and very small stature and low, he had a low birth rate. He's just very tiny for an 18-year-old. He's, you know, like 85 pounds and 5 foot. And that plays a role in how he feels about himself. He's very self-conscious. You know, he struggles with body image, wants to be a big kid, wants to do the things all the 18-year-olds do. But the scary thing is one of the primary characteristics of FASD is dysmaturity. So he may be 18 physically, but developmentally, emotionally, socially, he's more 10 or 12. So when you're operating, you know, so that came into play when you go and have your job, you go to work, you get a job. So he might be 18 and old enough to, my husband works in construction. So he works for his dad, but you could put an 18-year-old on a construction site, but if you wouldn't really put a 10-year-old on a construction site. But, and my son has got strengths, and that's a big part of how we parent. He can weld and he can build things out of wood, and he's very hands-on like that. And those are some of his strengths. But yet to navigate the social relationships and safety and making wise choices and navigating those things in an adult world, he doesn't have it. It's not there. So it's been harder to journey with him on this because he wants to be 18 and do all the things his 18-year-old friends are doing, but yet he's not ready, you know, for that kind of thing because he doesn't really make wise choices and scary choices because he doesn't have that emotional capacity to understand this is not safe and therefore I shouldn't do it. They really struggle also with that cause and effect and thinking through is that executive function and making decisions and that higher reasoning. Robbie Seale, a lot of times I'll hear her say these kids think any idea is a good idea. And whatever idea pops into their head, that's what they do. They don't think it through and plan out. They don't really have the skill set to do that. And that makes it scarier to parent them.
Yeah. Did they, this is a little bit of a strange question. So I'll back up and give you the story on it, right? So there's a British Olympic rower called James Cracknell, who's a TV personality now. And he's like, he got into Ironman triathlons and this stuff. So he's a big, very intense, very physically and emotionally intense character, very driven, you know? And when I say the word driven, I'm always reminded of something a mentor of mine told me. Like, if you're driven, there's somebody else in charge. You know, if you're driven, you're a passenger when talking about in a car. If you're driven, somebody else is in charge. And what he meant by that is kind of ego's in charge. It's macho bravado. In this case, this is, you know, that's clearly just my take on it, right? Now, this guy had he was cycling in on a interstate, I think, somewhere in the US, and he got knocked over by a truck. And he's got brain damage and he nearly died. And he was this always wanting to prove himself, you know, Olympic goals, you know, what's the next? This, that kind of never satisfied, what's the next thing? How can I do faster triathlons? And just going on and on. Now, he's got brain damage and he knows he's got brain damage. And yet he seems to me, just my opinion, right? He seems to trust his brain. Yeah. So he knows he's got brain damage, but he hasn't got the self-awareness to kind of double check his own brain. So he believes the stuff that is wrong because he doesn't have that kind of stuff. Does that make any sense?
Yes. Yeah.
And is that what kids who have FASD have? They don't have that kind of self-awareness. They trust their own brain too much.
Yeah they believe the things, you know, they can believe. For example, one of the symptoms would be, it's called confabulation, where there's a lot of memory deficits with FASD, and they'll fill in the blanks with how they think it should be remembered or what they think happened. And I see this actually with my older, and a lot of people think it's lying, and it's not lying. It can appear lying unless you look at it through, is this the brain? And my daughter, who I said is now 31, she'll be telling a story about, you know, when we were kids, we were doing this. And do you remember grandma said this? And, you know, so she'll tell this whole story and I'll be like, that's not how that happened. you know? And I used to think that's weird that she, like, why? It sounds like she's making it all up. And as I learned more about FASD, I'm realizing she's filling in blanks and it makes sense to her, but because she doesn't really remember it all, because memory is a big thing. And she did not have a diagnosis of FASD. She should have, but I had no idea back then when she came to live with us in 1999. And like I said, we didn't have any training classes, didn't know anything about trauma, didn't know anything about FASD. And because we weren't thinking, oh, adoption and foster care, I wouldn't have even read any of the books if there were even however many books were out there at that time.
So,
but what I know about her history is her mom, professional woman, not married, didn't think she could ever get pregnant, was told physically she had some issues, she probably would never get pregnant. And she probably was, you know, 8-12 weeks into her pregnancy before she realized she was pregnant, and drank socially on the weekends, every weekend. She was not an alcoholic, but didn't know she was pregnant. And we, you know, science is now saying there's no there's no known safe amount of alcohol to consume for a pregnant woman. And I know Jeff Noble's another podcaster. He has a show called FASD Success. And he has this little phrase all the time. If mom drinks, baby drinks. Mom drinks, baby drinks. And it's so eye-opening because I realized that while I kind of expected FAS and my children adopted from Eastern Europe because alcoholism is very prevalent over there, and my two youngest who are diagnosed FAS, they have the facial features, they check every box for the symptoms. And then here I look back now at this daughter that we raised and was so difficult in raising her. And though I know her mom was not an alcoholic, now I'm putting the pieces together and realizing this little girl probably was prenatally exposed to alcohol the first trimester, and the damage was done. And it shows up because she's got so many of the classic primary symptoms of FAS, but we did not know that that's what we were dealing with. And like I said, we wouldn't have looked for it because we didn't know what we didn't know. But that is the reality. And so they don't know things sometimes, and their brain will fill it in, and it can look like lying, but it's not. It just makes sense to them.
And what sort of response do you get? How do the kids respond when you share these insights with them about, you know, what you call this confabulation? How are they when you're taking in all this information, yeah, you're presumably chunking it down, or, you know, you're trying to think, how am I going to explain this? You're making that age appropriate, so it's going to be different for the 15-year-old to the 18-year-old, 30-year-old. How do they respond to this? How do they respond?
Well, my older daughter, when it comes to the confabulation, because it's not hurting anything, it's just how she remembers it. I don't point it out and say, oh, you're wrong. You know, grandma didn't, you know, buy a blue car, it was a red car, whatever. It doesn't hurt anything. I just roll with it. But like I said, my 18-year-old, he's really struggling with this because he doesn't want to be different. And even though in school, he was in special education, has an IEP, an individual education plan. So he had a lot of modifications and accommodations in school because of his disability. He also doesn't want to be different. He doesn't want to look different. He doesn't want to be labeled as disabled. He's kind of bucking against that, you know, which is understandable on one hand, but scary when you're the parent, because he needs to understand that there are things that he's going to need help with. And teenagers in general, they don't want help. And I don't know if it's the same where you live as here, but overall, teenagers tend to think they know everything, and we don't know anything as parents. So that plays into this as well. But when you have a brain-based disability, it's like scary. So one thing I've been trying to teach him a little bit about, you know, he now knows he has an FASD. He understands that. He doesn't like it. but I try to not make it a condemning thing, but like, you know, we're here to help you with this. So for example, in school, in his IEP, it spelled out that he needed extra time for things. He needed bigger projects broken down into smaller steps, and he needed one step at a time. And sometimes he needed directions repeated. He needed a lot of repetition and consistency. And he called me, so he graduated from school, and now IEPs don't really go with you after you graduate school, but they probably should. So he is at work, and we have the advantage that he works for his dad in construction, but construction is different every day. It's not repetitious so much. And he was sent out to get parts, couldn't find all the parts that were needed at the different places they sent him. And he was just really super frustrated, overwhelmed, called me just beside himself and so frustrated and miserable, and came home very cranky that day. And I said to him, you know, were you, I know you were frustrated today. Were you frustrated because you couldn't complete that task? Because he had a project he was assigned, and he needed to go get the parts for it. And his brain was on, I'm going to get these parts. But when you can't get all the parts, you can't then go to the next step. And another common symptom is perseveration, where they get fixated and focused on something and they can't get off of that. And it can be a strength. It can work to their advantage. Like if he's putting together something, when he was little and he loved Legos, he would get a Lego set and he would like start putting it together and not stop until it was done. Like he couldn't eat, he couldn't sleep, nothing else until that was done. So that's perseveration. So it can be used to your advantage. But in this case, his brain was perseverating on this project. He's going to get the parts for the project. The store didn't have all the parts, and he got stuck because his brain needed to finish that project, but he couldn't. And he was overwhelmed. And so we talked about it. And I said, Jordan, you remember in your IEP at school, it said that you needed to have those things broken down, you know, and into smaller steps, and because you couldn't get to that next step. And he was like, yeah. So I tried to connect the dots so he could see that this is what your brain wanted to do and you couldn't do it. And you became very frustrated, you know? So he made that connection, but there are other things like the kids like this, you know, individuals with an FASD also have a very hard time with abstract concepts like money. Money is a huge one. And there's a disconnect. Like he has a job, he gets a paycheck. He was refusing to have a bank account because he said the bank just takes your money. And I'm like, no, I have my money in the bank, and see, I have a bank statement. I actually have an app on my phone where I know exactly what's in my bank account. And he's like, no, the bank takes your money. And I started thinking about it, and I'm like, well, they do take your money. They don't keep it, but they do take it. But so then finally he lost a significant amount of money because he had money in his wallet and lost his wallet. And I felt horrible for him, but it's common. It's typical for him to lose things and misplace things because of the brain issue. But he had all this money in his wallet that he lost. So recently he graduated from high school and we had a party for him. So he was given cash for gifts. And some bank checks. So I said, we're going to open up a bank account because you're going to put the money in the bank. You'll have a debit card. It'll be a joint account so I can see where his money is going because he can't manage it. He has a very difficult time with that. So we go to the bank and we open the account and we make the deposit with the checks and with the cash. And he said to the bank teller, he said, so when I come to take money out of the bank, are you going to give me these checks back or can I get cash for them?
Yeah. Okay.
So like, you know, he didn't understand really something that we take for granted, which seems like common sense. His brain could not compute that because it was abstract, you know? Yeah. So abstract things. My older daughter had a very difficult time with, she got in trouble with, the car insurance company and the motor vehicle department in our state, because in our state, in the United States, in New York, you have to have insurance on a vehicle that has license plates. And if you don't have insurance, the motor vehicle fines you. You get fined for every day you're driving without insurance. Well, she had a job, she had a car, she had insurance, but car insurance is an abstract concept, right? It's like out there. It doesn't, you know, it's kind of hard to understand car insurance. So she stopped paying the bill and then got herself into enough trouble to where she was afraid to come to us and say, I'm in trouble with this. Can you help me? Because she didn't want to be in trouble. She thought we were going to yell at her. And in the end, we discovered that she had $1,000 in fines with the motor vehicle. Plus she owed the insurance company. And when we sat her down and asked her, and she had the money in her bank account. It wasn't that she didn't have the money, but she didn't have that connection to, I have to pay for this car insurance. It was very abstract and she didn't get it. So she sort of ignored it and then got into a whole lot of trouble by ignoring it and then didn't want to ask for help because then she didn't want to get into more trouble. So that's when these kids, as they get older and become, you know, enter that age of adulthood, it's scarier. When they're younger, our biggest thing was making sure they, you know, didn't ride their bike off a cliff or, you know, do kind of crazy things that these kids do. You know, my kids were doing all kinds of things and we were just trying to keep everybody safe and try to make sure that they were, you know, had special education and they were meeting their goals in school and make sure they're taking their shower and that kind of thing, brushing their teeth and wearing deodorant and those basic things that they need help with. But now as adults, as young adults, it's scarier because they can get into such trouble. And there's some of the outcomes if children and kids do not get the accommodations and the supports that they need along the way. Down the road, they can encounter problems with, the court system, getting in trouble with the law, drug and alcohol addiction. They're so vulnerable to being taken advantage of. And it can be a very scary place. So that we're trying to advocate for our kids so that they understand their disability themselves. And they understand that you can't just go do whatever you want to do. You need some supports. But it's, you know, it is scary because our 18-year-old is thinking, well, when I turn 19, I'm moving out. And it's like, you know, he's not, he will always need some type of a support person. He may not live fully independently. He's going to need some kind of help. He could live independently nearby us where we could be helping him, but he'll always need someone to help him navigate money, making sure he's not being taken advantage of, making sure he's eating properly because he does not, you know, he operates in a lot of ways like a 10-year-old and he would just eat sugar and fast food every day and that's it. Without the proper guidance. So a lot of support. My biggest soapbox really is for especially foster and adoptive parents to become trauma and FASD informed, because it's almost a guarantee if there's a child in the foster care system, they've probably been exposed to drug or alcohol in the womb. And parents are going to be encountering behaviors which are really symptoms. And there's a certain way to parent and we need to be informed and understand so that we don't do more harm than good.
Yeah. Wow. So it's all about the information is power, so that you know where you need to fill in where you need to make the allowances,
yeah,
because of the disability, and I guess that what's coming across to me is that the difficulty of helping the kids become self-aware, Are there any resources out there for the kids on this self-awareness stuff? Because you said, you know, that obviously teenagers, I mean, this is teenagers, all teenagers, think they know everything, and don't heed our advice. Are there any resources out there for kids that, you know, because they've not got your name on them, they might take more notice of?
Well, I it depends, I think, on, there are books there, and I'm starting to find books that are written by adults who have FASD. So it's their story. Some of the podcasts that I've listened to, the ones that I've already named with FASD Success, FASD Hope, they've been interviewing adults who have FASD and kind of telling their story of growing up and how, you know, how they navigated all of that and what they're doing today. So I think that can be helpful if you can get a kid to listen to. They can hear from someone who has the same disability and what life has been like for them. And it's been helpful for me as a parent, so I can better prepare. I wished I had been kind of feeding them this all along, had I known, because it's a little bit hard now to tell a 17-year-old, you know, you have a brain-based disability and, you know, you have poor memory, and, you know, so I try to focus more on the strengths, because that's a big part of their success, is because we, like, you know, everybody's always telling them what they can't do or what they're not good at, but we want to encourage them in their strengths. So my son's strengths are being hands-on, the fact that he can weld, he can build things out of wood, he can figure out how things work. So we try to make sure that we're giving him those opportunities at work and at home to do those things and feel successful, and give him lots of positive feedback about, you know, how well he's doing. And then at the same time, we're trying to point out, like, you're going to need some help with this, and I'm happy to help you. These are the things. So it's challenging. It definitely is challenging if you're starting out when they're teenagers and you're and trying to tell them this, which is, or make them at least aware and understand themselves. It's a tricky road to navigate, because I don't want him to feel like he's less than. I don't want him to feel shamed. But I want him to be informed so he can understand and ask for help, which also most teenagers don't want to do. My younger son is a little bit more, he's had the most significant FASD out of the two of them. But he's also open more to talking about what he needs, and he has counseling every other week. And we have a great counselor who understands FASD and attachment and different and trauma and adopted children. And so that's been very helpful, because we're learning strategies together with the counselor, he and I, and then we're applying them at home, because he can get stuck on, you know, talking about a certain topic, and then you need him to move on to something else, but he can't get off of a specific topic. It's part of that perseveration. So now we have, you know, we have a script where I'll say, okay, we're stuck on this. We need to go to this now. And he'll start to realize, oh yeah, I was stuck. And he'll willingly go on to the next topic with me. Those strategies are very, very helpful, but I didn't know those strategies, you know, when my 18-year-old was 15. And also what's been challenging is our 18-year-old never gave us any difficulty growing up. He had his quirks, because now I understand what perseveration is. He would perseverate on things and sort of drive us crazy talking about the same thing. Like, you know, if he wanted a certain Lego set and we ordered it online, he would want me to then track it online to know when it was going to be delivered. What day is it coming? And then on the day it's supposed to come, he would sit out by our mailbox and wait for the mail delivery person to deliver it. And if it didn't come like he thought it was supposed to, he'd want to then call the post office and like, where's my package? Because he was so fixated on this thing coming. That's perseveration. He has a wonderful personality. Everybody loves him. Had quirky things like that, and then had the physical, like he's very small in size. He had to have a lot of surgeries for his scoliosis and whatnot, but was not difficult and did not get into any trouble. Did not make trouble. But now, as he's, you know, his senior year of high school, through some negative influences that he was vulnerable to because he wanted to be with the big kids, he wanted to do all the big kids were doing, was introduced to vaping and introduced to marijuana and things like that, and just followed right along with all of that. And we pulled him out of, actually, he was in a vocational training school for welding during the day. He would go into his regular public school in the morning for special ed, and then he would go to this vocational school. And it was at the vocational school where he got exposed to some things that he didn't know how to navigate, those social situations, because he wanted to be accepted by these boys who were also 17 and 18, but yet he's mentally 10 and he wanted to be in there with those big kids, and that's what they were doing. So therefore that's what he did. So he really struggled, and it kind of started going off the rails, so to speak, in his senior year because of that, because we didn't realize this was not a good fit. Although he could weld and was on the honor roll for welding, he couldn't navigate the social, emotional climate there. And we pulled him out with 5 months left to go in that program, because we felt like if he keeps going down this road, he could end up, never mind the welding certificate, he would end up addicted to alcohol or drugs, which these individuals are very vulnerable to. So we pulled him out, and the school accommodated us when we said, instead of going to this program, he's going to go to work for his dad after work, which is where he's headed after graduation anyway. And you're going to count it as a work study because he's still going to be welding and doing these things. And we don't care about the certificate. Yeah. So the school agreed to that. But it was like the damage was already done. He's already made some bad friendships and exposed to some bad stuff that now we have to really stay on top of. Again, because he's an 18-year-old, really a 10-year-old in an 18-year-old body, and wants to do the 18-year-old things and really can't navigate that. So that's the most challenging. And I feel like we're in a season now with, as they're teenagers and older teenagers and young adults, where it's the outcomes are, it can be scary as a parent because they're so vulnerable to negative outcomes because of the poor memory, the confabulation, the executive function, and not being able to really process cause and effect and plan and organize, and they kind of go along with anything, and exposed to so much. So he can drive. So I track his phone. So I know that he's going to work and he's coming home, because if he goes anyplace else, I know. And then that's how we've caught him a couple places he shouldn't have been, in some dangerous situations. So we're trying to keep him safe, and we're trying to teach him that he needs to also consider safety. But he doesn't think that far ahead to know this is safe, or this isn't safe and therefore I shouldn't do it. So I think some of the most challenging season is where we are now with teenagers and young adults, until they kind of mature enough. Like my daughter, who's now 31, is in the best place she's ever been in her entire life. She's now married, has a job, but her like from the age 18 until probably 29, she was homeless at one point. She had multiple relationships. She was, you know, spent a night in a psychiatric hospital, was doing a lot of drinking. There was just a lot going on. And I did not have any understanding that she could be have been prenatally exposed to alcohol, and that what was really going on. But really that's what was really going on. And she didn't have the right supports, and we didn't know the symptoms early on. So it was, can I read the primary symptoms?
Yeah, sure.
Simon. So the primary symptoms of a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder would be that dysmaturity, that developmental level of functioning is much younger, sensory processing issues, nutrition issues. They can either, I know my one son would rather just eat sugar and fast food, and that's it. His body is driven by wanting sugar. Language and communication issues. So they may need speech therapy, things like that. Slow processing. So these kids are, you know, if you give them a list of things to do, if you bark a bunch of orders at them, like, I need you to clean your room, brush your teeth, get dressed, we got to go. They didn't catch even half of that. I've learned that my 15-year-old son, if I ask him what he wants for, what would you like for breakfast, cereal, toast, or eggs, he'll always pick the last thing that I said, because it was really the only thing that he remembered from the list. It doesn't, whether he wanted eggs or not, that's what he'll ask for, because that was the only thing he learned. So I've learned to like shuffle the list so the poor kid doesn't just eat eggs all the time. So there's that slow processing space, learning and memory issues, abstract thinking, like time management, money, those things, executive functioning, or that higher reasoning and decision-making, those things are all affected. So, you know, parents who are listening, if you're listening to that list and you're like, wait, that's my kid, could very well be because now trauma will present similarly as well. And my boys both have trauma, but they also both have FAS. There's some facial features and things that also go along with diagnoses, but our kids need us to focus on their strengths, and they need accommodations and support. They need help along the way. And if they're not getting that, if we're trying to constantly, like with my older daughter, constantly trying to make them like that, trying to fit that square peg into a round hole, insisting that they be able to do all of these things because they should be able to do all these things because we think they should, not understanding that, you know, there may be a brain-based disability going on here. If they're constantly frustrated and feeling like they're failing, it can lead to secondary symptoms, which are things like they can be easily fatigued, anxious, fearful. They can self-isolate, feel overwhelmed, argumentative, depression, frustration, anger, poor self-esteem, problems with family members, problems at school. And so those are some of the things we started seeing with our 18-year-old son. And it's definitely all the things we were seeing with our older daughter, because we didn't understand early on making those accommodations. You know, so now for our 18-year-old, he goes to work, but we also understand that physically, because of his small stature due to his disability and because of the FASD, he really can't work a 40-hour work week in construction. He, you know, you wouldn't send a 10-year-old to do that. So he'll, you know, and we've let him know, we don't expect you to work 40 hours, but let's come up with a schedule that you think you can do, whether it's 5 half days or whether it's, you know, 4 full days or just working, you know, but you have to follow your schedule. You know, you can't just decide every morning, I'm too tired to go to work, because when he does come home from work, he takes a nap, you know? And so we are understanding that, you know, we have to set the expectation so he can feel successful. He's not being lazy and he's not a failure, but physically and emotionally he's spent after being at work and trying to navigate, remembering and learning and doing all the things you have to do at work. It's hard. So he's exhausted at the end of the day. And so we have to allow him to, we have to understand that and work with him on that, so that he can feel successful and not feel like he's failing.
Wow. Well, when I said, I don't know how you do it all, I'm even more confused about how you do it all with all these extra things that you, the extra allowances that you have to make to take account their disability. So thank you so much for sharing your time and sharing your learnings with the listeners. That's really appreciated. And I'll actually put links to your website and your social on the show notes, so people can check you out and get in touch and check out your book. Obviously, I put some links onto Amazon as well there. Is there anything else that you'd like to share before we close off?
I would just say to parents listening, learn everything you can. Read everything that you can. I know there's one, they call it the gold standard book for FASD, and it's called Trying Differently Rather Than Harder by Diane Melbin. I'm sure Natalie Vecchione recommended the book. It's just a little handbook on FASD, just to begin to understand that it's not that our kids refuse or won't do certain things. They probably can't. And it's because of a brain-based disability, whether they've been diagnosed or not. So learn everything you can and positives, you know, build on their strengths, build them up, encourage them, focus on what they're good at and what they can do, connect with them. And it'll go a long way to helping them feel successful, but we have to stay the course and we have to provide those supports so they can be successful.
That's great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Simon, so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye-bye. See you again soon, listeners.